This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is Dee Dee Myers, political analyst and commentator, also contributing editor to Vanity Fair. She's a lecturer on politics, the media, and women's issues, and author of the 2008 New York Times bestselling book, Why Women Should Rule the World. If you remember, Dee Dee Myers served as White House press secretary during President Clinton's first term in 1993 and 94. The first woman to do that, and one of the youngest people to ever hold that job. Hard to believe, 20 years ago, nearly, that Dee Dee Myers was working in the White House. This Thursday, May 17th, she and former presidential advisor Karl Rove will share their insights on the presidential election of 2012 at 7:30 on the Cornell College campus. The lecture titled, Election 2012, Two Perspectives. Dee Dee Myers joins us now by phone. Welcome to River, Dee Dee.
Thanks, Ben. Great to be with you.
I wonder if you could start off by giving us the campaign narratives as you see them developing at this point, several months away from the general election, coming from the Obama and Romney camps.
Well, I don't think anybody wants me to speak for the Romney camp, but or the Obama camp, for that matter, as a analyst. But look, I think this is going to be an election. It's becoming a cliche, but that is decided or built very much around the economy. That's been the primary issue on voters' minds, not just in recent months, but in recent years. You know, the economy mostly, you know, in many ways appears to be coming out of the recession, but a lot of people are still feeling the pinch. I know things are a little better in Iowa, where your unemployment rate is substantially lower than the rest of the country, so you may be ahead of the curve, as you often are. But I think that's going to be the primary issue. I think President Obama is going to have to convince voters that he's the right person to continue to steer us toward recovery. And of course, Governor Romney is going to make the opposite argument, that President Obama has not successfully steered the country out of its current doldrums, and that he needs, you know, he can do a better job, and it will be up to voters to decide. Look, I mean, it's tough. We haven't seen this kind of recession since the Great Depression, and the recoveries in circumstances like this take longer than a normal recession. But voters aren't always patient when it's bread and butter issues, and you know, putting food on the table and sending their kids to college, and you know, providing adequate health care and worrying about their, not only their children's, but their parents' health and well-being. And so it's going to be a very close election. I don't think anybody doubts that.
Is the economy, the facts of the economy, will they be more or less what they are today, or are we waiting? Are political analysts waiting to see if there are some data there that will substantially sway to one side or the other?
You know, and that's the sort of right $60,000 question. Most economic analysts, most economists seem to agree that we won't have a double dip. We won't head into another technical recession. But people are very nervous about, for example, what's happening in Europe. And I think a lot of the factors that will shape this election, many of them will be outside the control of either candidate. Unemployment continues to creep down, but I don't think anybody expects to see a huge dip in unemployment between now and November. I think obviously the president hopes and expects that we might see continuing steady job growth. We've now had 25 consecutive months of private sector job growth, seeing more than 4 million jobs added to the economy. A lot of people have felt the improvements in that regard. There certainly are more jobs than there were a couple of years ago, but we haven't recovered nearly all the jobs we've lost in the last 4 years. And so there's too many people that are still standing outside the sort of emerging recovery or the green shoots that we're seeing. So I think most economists don't expect to see any huge change. Obviously, the president hopes we'll continue to see positive improvement, and I hope Governor Romney feels the same way, although I think that's less that doesn't portend as well, perhaps, for his chances if the economy gets stronger. And there was a poll today that suggested most people think the economy will be much better in the next year or two or three than it is now, even though they don't think it's in very good shape right now. So, you know, one of the things that I learned from President Clinton was that elections are always about the future. It sounds obvious, but it's not. It's about the future. It's not about the past. And the challenge for a leader who wants to put together an agenda, not only to win an election, but to be able to govern, is to get people to vote their hopes and not their fears. Mm-hmm. And I think that's incumbent on our leaders, not only to win elections, but in order to have some kind of a mandate to move the country forward. And I think people are really frustrated by the lack of progress, by the sort of inability of Congress and the executive branch to come together and get important stuff accomplished for people in a very challenging time. And so I hope that we can have a positive campaign about two different agendas, two different ways of getting to a better tomorrow. But again, I'm not sure that this will be a positive campaign.
Right. You've written that the 2012 presidential race could get downright nasty. Do any nasty moments up to this point come to mind?
Well, certainly the Republican primary was nasty.
Yeah.
I think one of the nastiest that we've seen in recent memories, and you know, there's a couple reasons for that. One is the stakes are high, right? You had five candidates with no front runner. I mean, Romney was often the front runner, but he wasn't a very commanding front runner for most of the election, so everybody had a chance, and so there's more incentive to sort of try to knock the other guy out of second place and move into first place. I think another reason is that with the Supreme Court decision on Citizens United allowing a lot of unregulated money and undisclosed money into the campaign cycle, you had people like Newt Gingrich, who would have been out of the race but for the largesse of one donor, right? So you had a lot more money flowing in to fund those negative ads. And then I think, you know, you just have a lot of dissatisfaction among Republicans and conservatives with the current president. And so I think all of that contributes to a very competitive and very nasty primary campaign. Now we're moving into a different phase, right? Now for the first time, we have a two-person, two-party race, Democrats versus Republicans, President Obama versus Governor Romney. And we're just starting to see that race take shape. Last week, we saw President Obama come out with a positive commercial, sort of talking about his record. This week, we see President Obama beginning to try to define Governor Romney, not necessarily positively, by raising questions about a decision that Bain Capital made around a steel plant in Kansas City that went bankrupt and cost a lot of people their jobs. So, some people think that ad's unfair. I happen to think it raises some very interesting questions and important questions about what are the values of our leaders. You know, and that's a robust part of this conversation. As a purely, you know, procedural matter, I think it's going to get nasty now between the Obama and Romney camps, because I think both campaigns believe that the next couple of months between now and no later than the start of the Olympics at the end of July is the opportunity for each to define the other.
You think after that it's more or less sort of crystallized?
I think in terms of defining who your opponent is, yeah. Then you go into we have the Olympics, you know, for 3 weeks, and then you're into August, and people are traditionally less engaged in sort of what's going on. And then we come back to the conventions, and then a very short window from the conventions to the election in November. And a lot of times by mid-September, and the Democratic convention doesn't happen until after Labor Day this year, so it's very, very late, people have pretty firm views of who these two candidates are.
If you've just joined us, D.D. Myers is my guest, a political analyst and commentator, and we're talking a little bit about the election right now. You know, D.D., in order to win the GOP primaries, Mitt Romney had to tailor his appeal in large part to the Christian conservative wing of the party on several different issues. Do you think this will haunt him at all in this general election phase, or will that be, to use a campaign advisor of his words, etch-a-sketched away just fine?
I do think that will be a problem for him, and certainly it will be. The Obama campaign sees it as their mission to make sure people don't forget some of the more partisan and what they would say extremist remarks and positions that Governor Romney has taken. You know, traditionally campaigns have kind of moved to the right or left during the primaries to appeal to base voters, core voters, and then tried to move back to the center in the general election to try to reach out to those, you know, independents and soft voters in the other party. And Romney has a more complicated challenge because he was a moderate and he moved so far to the right to win the Republican primary. It's difficult for him to move back. I mean, you can flip, but and then you can flop, but you can't flip, right? You can't move away from those kind of positions again. And I think that's going to be the challenge for him. They'll try to move ahead as if, you know, some of the things that happened during the primaries never happened. Voters do tend to have short memories, but the Obama campaign will, I think, take many opportunities to remind people. There's a lot of video out there, which we'll see on TV and on the internet, and there's going to be a lot of money. It's going to be the most expensive campaign in history. And not only are the campaigns going to be spending millions of dollars, but the independent expenditure committees will be spending millions of dollars, particularly on the Republican side. They just raise more money, more corporate money. And so I think you can expect it to get, you know, we're going to be reminded of warts and all, and mostly of warts on both sides.
The Washington Post called this president, President Obama, the first female president as he seeks the female vote in November recently. He spoke on daytime TV, The View, this week, giving a speech also at an all-women's school in recent days. His re-election campaign has been working for months to exploit the so-called and considerable gender gap that polls reveal. You said the economy is key. Is the women's vote also a key to November?
It is, and those two things are linked. You know, I think women, because so many, you know, half of Americans, and that's obviously half of women and of men, are unmarried. And among the most vulnerable people in the country are unmarried women. They tend to be either widows or they're divorced with children, they're single parents, they're young women that aren't yet married. And I think the economic, because again, they so often have children they're supporting as well as themselves, that the soft economy affects them more immediately. They feel those kitchen table issues more immediately. So that's one of the reasons. And the other is that we've seen in this campaign, you know, I would describe it, and, you know, sort of moving women forward is one of the things I'm passionate about. So here I go on my considerable, you know, mission, crusading. I think that, you know, that in the Republican primary campaign, we saw all the candidates trying to roll back the clock on progress women have made, from equal pay. None of them support the Lilly Ledbetter Act, which was the first thing that President Obama signed, which allows women to go out there and demand equal pay for equal work. We're only making 77 cents for every dollar that men make, so this is still a huge issue, particularly when you combine it with the soft economy. On things like access to preventive health services, including birth control, people wanted to tell women that they weren't really up to making those decisions for themselves. That infuriated women, and not just Democratic or independent women, but conservative women as well, who thought, I can't believe we're relitigating these questions. So I think across the board, we talk about women's rights and women's opportunities and the economic progress that women have made and the responsibility that they have as breadwinners, not only as single women, but also in married households. I think this is a huge vulnerability for Governor Romney, and it's important to keep in mind that there has been a gender gap since the 80s. In 2008, 10 million more women voted than men, and they voted overwhelmingly more for President Obama. So, not overwhelmingly, but by 8 or 9 points. And so when you combine those two things, more women voted, and they voted for President Obama by a sizable margin, you know, it adds up to real numbers. And so Governor Romney better get think a lot about why he's not doing better among women and see if he can't try to appeal to them.
Dee Dee Myers, you were White House Press Secretary in 93 and 94. Wasn't this the time that you had to deal a lot with don't ask, don't tell in the military? So this must be an interesting time for you, as President Obama has just voiced his support for same-sex marriage.
In 1993, 1994, same-sex marriage wasn't even an option, right? I mean, the country just wasn't there. I mean, the country is still divided over it, but much less so. I'm stunned, quite frankly, by, you know, it was sort of a big deal in some ways when the president came out in support of same-sex marriage, but it wasn't the bombshell even that allowing gay men and lesbians and others to serve openly in the military was 20 years ago. And that is a sea change in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
When the president came out in support of letting, well, the president-elect, if you recall how it happened, in before President Clinton took office as president-elect, he said that, and he had said during the campaign that he favored allowing gays to serve openly in the military, and it became the huge first big scandal of the Clinton administration. And among the opponents were, you know, Democratic members of the Senate, like Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia, who was the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, who just didn't think the country was ready, didn't think the military was ready.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward to this last year, when the president was able to finally abolish Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and one of the primary voices in supporting that was Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mike Mullen, who I thought took a very courageous stand. He said, I've been serving the military since 1968, and I've always served with gay people. I don't think this is an issue. And the policy was changed, and the people are now allowed to serve openly, and we're still standing as a country. Now, the president's support of gay marriage doesn't change anything materially, because he supports, as do most senators and others, letting states decide that, and there are many states that have already banned it through initiative processes or legislative processes. But I do think to have a president come out and openly say that, and have most people say, I don't think it's going to be a big deal come Election Day, That is a dramatic social shift in a very short period of time.
Polls indicate, though, that it seems to be Obama picking up as much support as he is losing with that announcement, right?
Yeah, I think so.
It's a wash.
I mean, it's kind of a wash, exactly. I mean, there was another poll that said some small number, 8 or 9%, said that they only 8 or 9% said it would affect their vote on Election Day. And it seems like those 8 or 9% are the people who are most rabid, you know, who are most have the strongest convictions on one end or the other, right? Everybody else is like, well, okay, but let's, you know, it's people who said, I support gay marriage, but I'm not going to vote for Obama. And others have said, well, I don't support gay marriage, but I'm still going to vote for the president. So it's a wash.
Let's even skip this election for now and throw ourselves into 2016, even though
never too soon to start looking at the next election cycle.
Right. Not especially not if you're in Iowa. Right.
Right.
You're always
It'll
thinking
be like 15 minutes before they start showing up for the next round. So.
Now, even though Hillary Clinton has said she will not seek the Democratic nomination for president in 2016.
I don't think she said that exactly.
No. Do you have an exact quote?
My recollection without having it in front of me is something like, I'm not planning to.
Okay. Well, according to a new public policy polling survey out last week, Dee Dee, more than half of Iowa Democrats, 62%, say they want her as the nominee in 2016, followed by, with 14%, Vice President Joe Biden, and then in the single digits, Elizabeth Warren, Andrew Cuomo. Would you, you sound like you would not rule out Hillary as a presidential bid in 2016?
I would not rule it out. I honestly don't think she's decided. I don't think she, you know, there's any reason for her to have decided. She has done a spectacular job as Secretary of State. She has never enjoyed broader public support and across party lines. I don't think a lot of, you know, I don't think that would continue if she were to enter the fray as a Democratic candidate for president. But I mean, I think she has become almost an iconic political figure in the country, and God bless her. So, and of course, you know, you won't be surprised to hear that I'm a big supporter of hers and a huge fan, and I think it's been a remarkable journey for her. So I think she's tired. She's exhausted. She's traveled millions of miles as a president's secretary of state. I think she's the standout member of the cabinet. She's going to take some time off. She's going to think about what her next steps are. There are a huge number of people in the Democratic Party and across the country who urge her to run everywhere she goes.
You'll be appearing with Karl Rove this Thursday on the Cornell College campus. How would you describe your relationship with Karl Rove?
Karl was my neighbor in Washington for quite a while. We've done other appearances like this. We're definitely friendly. We don't see each other a lot outside of sort of running into each other occasionally around Washington or doing things like this. But and we, I think it's fair to say we disagree about a lot of things, but we try to do it agreeably. Karl's a very friendly guy, as people who come to see him in Mount Vernon at Cornell College on Thursday, we'll see. He's a true believer. He gives as good as he gives as good as he gets, and he's a very smart guy. And so I look forward to you know, to having a conversation with him about how we each see the world. And there won't be a lot of places where we agree, but there'll be some. There are always some, which is nice.
Dee Dee Myers, thank you for joining us for this time on River to River. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben. Good to be here.
Once again, Dee Dee Myers will be appearing with Karl Rove to share insights on this presidential election at 7:30 this Thursday, May 17th, on the Cornell College campus. The title of their presentation, Election 2012, Two Perspectives. Incidentally, worth mentioning, Karl Rove was invited to be on this program as well. He declined our invitation. And coming up next, we'll look at competitive swimwear that will be worn by U.S. Olympic athletes at the Summer Games in London. Iowa State University kinesiology professor Rick Sharp helped develop Speedo's new Fast Skin 3 racing system. That's next on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Remember the Beijing Olympics in 2008 and all those swimming records that were shattered? Well, Olympic swimming records are set to tumble once again in London's Olympics as Speedo unveils the new Fast Skin 3 swimwear system. Joining us now to talk about it is Rick Sharp. He is an Iowa State University kinesiology professor. He helped develop Speedo's FastGen 3 racing system along with the company's global research and development facility. And Rick Sharp, welcome to River to River.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before I have you go into some details on FastGen 3, let's set the scene by going back 4 years to those Olympic Summer Games we remember well in Beijing to talk about Speedo's Laser Racer. These were the high-tech suits in those games, which were, in 2009, I understand, outlawed for what they called technological doping. You also helped design that suit. Tell us about the laser.
Well, the laser was a pretty new approach to designing swimwear in the sense that Speedo was the first company to really start to test different aspects of swimmer performance to determine what exactly are the qualities that help somebody to really swim fast, be able to compete well, and really launched a very involved effort in trying to design new fabrics, new approaches to the design and the cut of the suit itself to help to reduce drag. And they were pretty successful in doing that, and I think the results speak for themselves.
Okay, what made the Laser Racer so revolutionary?
Well, it was the use of primarily of a couple of things. There was a combination of the usual nylon Lycra type elastic material that really is form-fitting, while at the same time not being bulky at all, and really fitting the swimmer well and holding in their skin so the skin doesn't wobble around much when they swim through the water at those speeds, combined with the fact that there were also some panels that were put on there that are made out of polyurethane, which is kind of almost like a rubberized fabric. And those panels were put over parts of the body where the highest drag or water resistance is usually experienced by swimmers. And all of those things together just added up to a pretty remarkable reduction in the amount of water resistance that was experienced during the races.
And if we remember how they looked, this is almost a full body suit, isn't it? For the men as well.
Yeah, back in 2008, that suit went from primarily the suit that was worn went from ankles all the way up to over the shoulders for both the men and the women.
Okay. Then, and it was astounding, as you said, that it speaks for itself. I have here noted 23 new world records in swimming in that Olympiad.
Yeah, that was a pretty remarkable result, far greater than anything we could have expected as scientists, designers, casual observers.
Did anybody win who wasn't wearing a Laser Racer?
Yeah, I think there were a couple of medals set by other folks as well.
Then in 2009, the Laser Racer, this full-body revolutionary suit made by Speedo that you helped design, was outlawed for technical doping. I've never heard that term up to that point. What is technical doping?
Well, I'm not sure that it's anything that's legislated. It's not an official term. It was a term that was used by one of the Italian swim coaches who was arguing against the use of these new suit designs, because what happened was after the Laser Racer came out, then other companies started producing similar products. Some were using neoprene, which is kind of a wetsuit material, and added buoyancy, and things just got really out of hand in terms of how rapidly all of the records were falling after the Beijing Olympics. And the governing body for world swimming, which is called FINA, decided to review their rules about swimwear and what the restrictions would be, and they decided to impose tighter restrictions to prevent manufacturers from coming up with basically flotation devices and things that sort of obscured the swimmer's performance. And because the trend was that it started to appear that the attention was more being focused on what garment they were wearing than it was on the athlete.
So FINA, the International Swimming Federation, outlawed exactly what?
They came out with a set of restrictions that prevents the use of anything like polyurethane panels that we had before. They set limits on the kinds of other textiles or fabrics that could be used. All has to be a thread-based material now. They've limited the degree of coverage, so a women's suit can only come down now to the top of the knee and obviously up over the shoulders as well. And the men's suit can only be the jammer style, which goes from waist down to the top of the knee.
Okay, so a lot of constraints put on you by FINA. So you go back to the drawing board, and then how do you create Fast Skin 3? Describe that in comparison to this full-body suit, the Laser Racer.
Well, the women's suit, it doesn't look a whole lot different, but because the only thing that was lost in terms of coverage is that lower leg. But it is definitely a thread-based fabric that's made out of a pretty elastic type of fabric. But what's pretty unique about it is that most elastic fabrics have the same degree of stretchiness, or what we refer to as elastic power, how strongly it can hold in your skin. It has very varied levels of that elastic power over the different parts of the body. So areas that might need a little bit more control of the skin are given a little bit more elastic power to really hold them together.
So in other words, this suit reshapes the swimmer's body.
It reshapes it to an extent. It doesn't reshape it much, but it mostly just controls the skin. Now, if you look at any well-trained swimmer, you know, they certainly aren't flabby by any means, but every human skin is pretty flexible. And at speeds that they go at in the water during races, the skin will flap or flutter around, which adds quite a bit of drag. So any kind of suit that they wear that's nice and tight, form-fitting, is going to help to control some of that to an extent. And this does it very well by really being precise about where it's adding that extra support.
Now this system is also the first one to include not only the suit, but also the goggles and the cap. They're built for each other.
Yeah, that's correct. What Speedo did was they decided to approach this project as an integrated whole, or sum of the three parts, the goggles, the cap, and the suit, and not just put all of their attentions on designing a suit for this next Olympics.
If you've just joined us, my guest is Rick Sharp, Iowa State University kinesiology professor. He helped develop Speedo's Fast Skin 3 racing system along with the company's global research and development facility. Fast Skin 3 is expected to be worn by many of the top swimmers at this year's London Olympics. Also joining us now, Tiana Wolin. She is an Iowa State University senior majoring in chemical engineering, originally from Bloomington, Minnesota, and the captain of the Iowa State women's swimming team. Tiana, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Now, I understand that you first tested the Fast Skin 3 in the spring of last year. You swam in it for the first time. You've also swam in this system competitively at the Big 12 Championships earlier this year. How is it different than the suits you were wearing before?
I'd say the biggest difference is the type of material that it's made out of, like Dr. Sharp said. It doesn't give as much. It's not as elastic. And so just getting it on itself is a big task. And it comes with gloves, I know, to help
really?
Make it easier. Mm. Yeah.
How long does it take you to put it on?
The first time we put it on, it took a good, I want to say, about half an hour. But after the first time, you get more used to it and it shapes more to your body, so it doesn't take quite as long. Mm-hmm. But
is there a zipper on this, or do you have to somehow put it on differently?
This one's different because they were going for the full closure on the back. And so what it is instead you have to like take the two straps that go over your shoulder and pull it to the side and like kind of step in sideways and then pull it all the way up. And once it's up and fitting good on the hips and everything like that, then you pull one of the straps over the head and on. So no zipper, but full coverage on the back.
Professor Sharp mentioned that it sort of reshapes the body of the swimmer. Do you feel that when you put it on?
Yeah, you definitely feel compressed a lot. It really helps to like kind of tighten the core, I guess you would say. When you're swimming, you can definitely feel it. enclosed.
It feels like you're being compressed a bit. So it doesn't sound very comfortable to me.
No, I mean, all the suits that are kind of racing suits and elite suits, they're made to be tight, so to fit you well. And the fit is one of the biggest things. And so all of them are tight, but I mean, they don't restrict your movements or anything like that. But it's just what you have to get used to.
This is not a suit you wear for training, is it?
No, we do not train in this.
Mm-hmm. Have your times improved, especially when you were at the Big 12 championships?
Yeah, they were better. It was pretty similar to the elite, but that's because I had an injury, I guess, last fall. So I wasn't going for like life best times.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we take it off of sort of statistics, 11% of this and 16% of this, can you, as a competitive swimmer, notice when you have this suit on? Do you feel like you glide through it, or could it be a figment of your imagination if you didn't look at times?
No, I definitely can tell the difference when I have the suit on. I really like the way it fits, especially on the core. I feel like it fits better than the previous suits because it really closes in tightly. And like I said before, like, fit is one of the most important things about it.
The goggles and the cap are part of this system made by Speedo. Do they feel different? Do they work differently?
Yeah, the goggles are kind of made so on the corners of them, they're bent so that your peripheral vision is more enhanced. So the first time I put them on and dove in the water, I felt like dizzy and stuff at first because I wasn't used to the way the goggles were bent. And after swimming with it a little bit, I got more used to it. But it just allows for a greater view range around you.
So you can see more like your normal vision.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does this design change the swimming technique at all, Tiana? Did you notice that?
I don't know if it really changes the technique. It helps to stabilize the core a lot better. And so generally that could be a problem for some people. And putting it on, this helps fix it and makes their technique better that way because the core is already stabilized and you don't have to think about that. But
mm-hmm. Rick Sharp, do you think it changes the swimming technique when you observe it in the pool?
Well, it doesn't look like that. In fact, it's designed not to influence technique. We're very careful in both design and testing to look for evidence of restricted motion and how swimmers might compensate if they feel like, you know, it's inhibiting their ability to really stretch out in their stroke. Those sorts of things we're really careful about. But where it might influence technique is as the swimmer fatigues late in the race, because a lot of times, and this is true at the Olympic level just as it is at the high school level or any other level, as swimmers fatigue, they start to lose their mechanics a little bit. And so they wiggle around a lot more. There's a lot more lateral motion when they swim. And a well-designed competition suit will usually provide a little bit of added support that can not prevent, but at least reduce that tendency for the swimmer to, quote unquote, start falling apart at the end of races.
How was this suit tested? Is it tested always on humans, or are there some kind of human forms that it's tested on in sort of a wind tunnel type of thing?
Well, first, the fabrics are all tested in wind tunnel and also using some laboratory-based tests to look at water repellency and things like that, stretchability, elastic power. But then once the suit is actually designed, the models are put into computer as well. And we use a process, well, Speedo uses a process called computational fluid dynamics, which is kind of like having a wind tunnel in the computer, because you can put these 3D computer-generated models and put the suit on there and then simulate what would happen to some of the drag forces and things as water flows by at race speed. So undergoes a lot of testing in the computer. And then if everything sort of passes muster there, then the suit's brought out to some swimmers, and we do a fairly large number of different tests while swimmers are wearing the suit, where In some cases, they're dragged through the water or towed through the water, and passive drag is measured. There's some time trial results where swimmers are tested for their start performance, turn performance, mid-pool swimming performance. And then here at Iowa State, we do all of the economy testing, where what we do is have the swimmers swim some standardized distances during their practice with the suit and different suits that we're testing. And we monitor their oxygen uptake when they swim at a given speed, and that tells us how economical they can be when they're wearing the suit.
Wow.
So quite a range of testing is done with the suits, yeah.
Wow. How many swimmers in London will be wearing the fast skin? Will it be the majority?
Well, I don't have any clue about how many will wear it. It just kind of depends on how well Speedo can really penetrate the market and supply it to everybody that might want it. In Beijing, it was almost everybody was wearing it practically, and I used to like to crack the joke that when somebody would ask me whether that made the difference in Michael Phelps winning the 8 gold medals or not, I would say, no, absolutely not, because the person who got last place in those events was also wearing the suit, so it had no impact on the outcome.
And looking toward the future, do you see, as a kinesiology professor, a way to eke out even more performance from future suits?
Well, I think we can always improve. And you know, the thing to always remember is that when we're talking about athletic performance, there's probably 1,000 or more different factors that go into any one performance. And so we might be focused on improving one little aspect of that performance, but there's still plenty of other opportunities for athletes to improve. And I would never predict the end of the progress of these athletes.
Tiana, as a collegiate swimmer, as a competitive swimmer and captain of the Iowa State swimming team, does this leave anything, any wishes unfulfilled? Do you have any suggestions about where you'd like to see suits go in the future?
Well, I really like, with this new suit, the full coverage on the back. That was really key importance to me. As far as the future, and if the guidelines or the rules stay in place, how it can't go lower than the knees, I would say maybe just more easiness or like flexibility with the material when you do have to like scrunch up like into turns and everything like that. Otherwise, if there was a way to somehow put it on a little bit easier, just because they take a while, but otherwise than that, I'm not too picky.
Okay, maybe a machine that you can just stand there and it paints it on you or something, huh?
I would love that, something to jump into or...
Well, we've often dreamed about a swimsuit and a spray can.
Yep, we have joked about that.
Well, we'll look forward to 2016. Maybe that's something you'll come up with, Rick.
I wouldn't count on it.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rick Sharp, Iowa State University kinesiology professor. He helped develop Speedo's Fast Skin 3 racing system. And also Tiana Wolin. She is the captain of the Iowa State women's swimming team. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.